I'll ask the marshal to call our final case that we have set for argument today.
A230565, in the matter of the petition of U.S. Bank, National Association of Legal Title Trustee for Truman 2016 SC6 Title Trust for a new certificate of title after mortgage foreclosure sale.
All right. Council, you'll both have 15 minutes for your argument. Appellant, go ahead and have a seat and get settled in. Council, for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Please pay attention to the clock on the podium. Also, you'll notice on the right, your right, the podium, there's little buttons that will raise it up and down, so you can go ahead and adjust it accordingly. Please also state your name for the record, because we do keep a recording of this, so we know which party you're representing. So, Council for appellant, when you're ready, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Matthew Anderson, and I represent the appellant, James Mandel. We're here on two issues: whether the foreclosure as a matter of law extinguished this easement termination agreement, and then secondly, whether the court erred in placing too much of a burden on my client to prove up bad faith at the summary judgment hearing.
Well, there's a preliminary issue as well, whether we address either, neither, or both of those in light of the motion to dismiss.
Correct. So for this court to hear the issue has to be preserved, to preserve an issue presented to the court and considered by the court. And here we have the issue of junior and senior liens presented to the court at the hearing. That was the basis of the argument that the mortgage was senior to the easement termination agreement. And then the court, examiner, and then adopted by the court, had in two places in its memorandum found that there was no consent or subordination from the mortgage holder.
I know that was discussed by the court, but I mean, I have to tell you that, you know, you're defending a client, you move for summary judgment. I mean, there's no summary judgment brief, there's no prior request for continuation, and then a lawyer shows up at the hearing and says, basically, I got nothing. And it's true, the court went on and issued a decision, but how do we get around Thiel v. Stitch? It feels like sandbagging if we do. Why shouldn't that be our concern?
I'll answer that a couple ways. First, there was a request for continuance. It was denied.
Which is a decision that's not on appeal.
Is not on appeal. That's correct. That was discretionary. We're not challenging that. But as far as the concern of sandbagging, in this case specifically, and what was in the record is that who my client thought was his attorney had resigned, and the notices were going to an email that wasn't being monitored. And so this isn't a concern of people going, I'll save my best argument for appeal.
No, I mean, fair enough that it's not intentional, but if you're on the defense side of things, like we briefed this, we argued it, we brought discovery requests, nothing from the plaintiff, and now we're on appeal addressing arguments that were never presented in the district court.
Well, they were never presented by my client at the summary judgment hearing. But the issue of subordination and the issue of senior and junior liens was the basis of the mortgage, was the basis of the motion, and it was what the district court considered and ruled on in its orders. And the case cited by the respondent, the pinnacle case cited by respondent, is Crablex. And Crablex stands for the proposition that a junior interest can be subordinated by agreement from the mortgage holder. So that shouldn't have been a surprise that this could be an issue or is an issue. And it's inherent in the discussion of whether there is
Well, it's not about whether it's a surprise. It's like, okay, we presented the argument. there was no counter argument. There was nothing presented to the district court.
Right. And it's still the obligation of the moving party to prove their case at summary judgment. And the
But it's the obligation of the responding party to provide a counter argument and evidence to provide to suggest that there's a disputed issue of material fact.
Well, unless that evidence is already in the record. And what was submitted in the record was not only the mortgage, which has language indicating that appurtenances are automatically added to the property, but there was also the quitclaim deed in which respondent purchased the property from the previous owner together with appurtenances. And so that's in the record, and that's the basis of the appeal, is that those two documents come together and form a consent to the any appurtenances that would have been added in between those two documents, which would include the easement termination agreement. And in both Crablex and Ben's Sons versus Willer, they both discuss this idea that the subordination or the consent to an interest can come after that interest. It doesn't have to be in the document that is being held senior to the mortgage.
Well, right? In Crablex, in that case, wasn't the mortgage holder a party to the agreement that was in dispute later on, and that distinguishes this case?
In Crablex, the mortgage holder was a party to the later settlement agreement that then subordinated the mortgage to easements, but it wasn't the party to the actual interest or any document to the actual interest that was being held senior to the mortgage, right? And here we have the mortgage holder, which is a party to the mortgage, to the contract, and then later is a party to the quitclaim deed.
But not a party to the agreement that it's being challenged.
That's correct.
And why isn't that a dispositive distinction?
Because the subordination agreement does not have to be in the interest or in the contract of the interest that is being held senior to the previous interest. So what happened in, for example, in Willer, in Ben's Son versus Willer, that was an issue of whether a lease agreement survived the foreclosure on a larger property. And what the court had said there is, well, there wasn't any type of agreement that it would, but if there was an implied agreement afterwards, then the mortgage holder who foreclosed would then take on the lease. There just needed to be an implied agreement or implied consent to do so, even though the mortgage holder wouldn't have been a party to that lease agreement.
And what's the implied agreement in this case?
The implied agreement here comes in from the mortgage document itself, which says that defines property as all easements, appurtenances, and fixtures, now or hereafter part of the property. And it also comes in the quitclaim deed that happened a year and a half after the foreclosure, which says that it exchanged valuable consideration with Anistad for the property together with appurtenances. And so the easement termination agreement would be one of those
so
appurtenances.
So you're interpreting the lessened bundle of rights as for this easement as an appurtenance, and then is that right?
That is exactly how I'm interpreting it, and yes, it is right.
Dictionary definition, how does that support what you're arguing?
An appurtenance would be the sort of incorporeal rights and interests that are necessary for the full enjoyment of a property. And those interests can be defined broadly and includes easements. And what this easement termination agreement did is it did not just offer to Anistad, who was the previous property owner, who had the agreement with my client. Anistad did not just agree to completely get rid of that easement. What he agreed to is that he would get rid of it for himself, and then upon sale, he would have the opportunity to sell the easement subject to my client's right to buy it for $75,000. And this happened in 2008. And I think it's difficult now for us to imagine a scenario where properties lose value, but in 2008, securing $75,000 on an interest, that is something that does add security to the property.
But the mortgagee didn't agree. agree to that. I mean, there's no agreement there. Okay, all right, sorry. I don't have a question, I guess.
Right, well, yes, the mortgage holder did not and was not a part of the easement termination agreement. And I'd say under Crablex and under Willer, it didn't have to be. It just had to have some type of consent, either before or after, that something like that could be added, which we're pointing to the language in the mortgage and the language in the quitclaim deed.
I have a hard time reading the language in the mortgage as providing the consent that you're suggesting.
Well, both respondent and I cited two cases outside of this jurisdiction, a California case and a New Hampshire case. And both of those courts read nearly identical language to say that it automatically added certain interests to the property. And so I think that the same effect happens here. And for example, if this easement agreement didn't reserve the right to terminate, let's say that this easement agreement widened the easement, you know, respondent would be pointing to this language and saying, see, we foreclose on a bigger easement now. Right, so I don't think that there should be any reason why it can't.
The whole point is that this reduced Onstead's property interests, arguably. I mean, isn't that the problem? If it increased it, then it would be an easement, or depending on the nature of it, maybe an appurtenance. But decreasing it is the issue, I guess. It seems to me.
Right, and I understand that, and I'd say two things about that is that the, well, first of all, the mortgage itself doesn't limit it to things that add value to the property. And what it does is it automatically adds these easements, appurtenances, fixtures, and improvements. And an improvement or a fixture does not necessarily add value to a property. I mean, if there is an improvement put on the property that detracts value, the bank takes the property subject to that type of improvement. And so it's not really a workable rule to say we only take things that increase our property value.
To an improvement, I'm trying to imagine an improvement that, so you're saying like a defective improvement that decreases value? And
well, correct. Or something buyers are no longer looking for, right? The trend of...
But an improvement is, I mean, that attaches to the land. I mean, we're talking about an agreement to give something away that diminishes the value, diminishes the thing in which the mortgage is being held.
I, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree that he gave it away. The agreement was that he could sell it for $75,000, and I do think that that is a big deal. I mean, again, imagine a situation where property values decrease. Onstead is upside down on the property. Well, he can sell this easement for $75,000, and thereby that gives some securement to the bank, or some security to the bank that their mortgage will get paid back in that sale. Again, this is 2008 and 2023.
Well, I should say maybe potentially decreases. I mean, the mortgage holder in foreclosure would obviously, apparently in this case, believes that the easement is more valuable than the $75,000.
Well, I'd guess that the bank believes that it's...
Well, it has to be, otherwise we wouldn't be here.
Well, that's correct, but I don't... I think that it's still unworkable for here to sit here and say, well, if it's something that adds a certain amount of value or adds value, then yes, we take it. If it doesn't add value, that's not something we take. There's no way to draw that line. And to answer your question on what type of improvement might do that, imagine a 10 by 10 foot granite statue of a hand sitting in the front lawn. Yes, there could have been a lot of money spent on that. That's technically an improvement. But is that something that increases value to the property? Well, there's no real way to know that. And so the bank would take... in a mortgage, would take the property with that hand, regardless of the impact it has on the overall property value. But again, back to what the mortgage actually says and what those two outside cases, one from California, one from New Hampshire, both of those referred to the plain language of the mortgage to make its decision. And there's nothing in the plain language of the mortgage that says we take only that which increases property value. And then finally, I do want to spend some time on the quitclaim deed because a lot of respondents' argument hinges on this idea that it cleanly foreclosed, no redemption, therefore we take everything, or we therefore everything else is extinguished. And I think that that's not necessarily true to what happened here. In the record is that quitclaim deed, and we can't ignore the obvious. A quitclaim deed is when a property owner transfers their property to somebody else. And so it's inconsistent for there to be a finding that the respondent had received all of that property at the time of foreclosure and sheriff sale, when a year and a half later it had to purchase that property from Anastad, the previous owner, which is a sale that would have triggered the easement termination agreement by its plain terms. And respondent knew of this because it was registered with the property. And just to wrap it up, I think this is sort of a situation where, to no fault of his own, my client did not respond to the summary judgment motion, right? And but that doesn't mean he had to lose. Respondent still had to prove its case, and on this record, there was enough to say that it was not entitled to summary judgment at that time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, and you'll have 5 minutes for a rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, when you're ready, you'll have 15 minutes.
May it please the court, Kevin Dobie on behalf of U.S. Bank National Association as legal title trustee for Truman 2016 SC6 Title Trust. I don't have a lot to say. I'll start with some brief facts and one discrepancy that I noticed this morning when reading the appellant's brief, and it's a minor error, and I doubt it was intentional. I just think I overlooked it when I first read the appellant's brief, but that is that in appellant's opening brief, page 3, appellant states that Anastad, the prior owner, mortgagor, purchased the property on May 27th, 2008, cites index number 30, paragraph number 5, but that declaration of Kevin Dobie, the index number 30, paragraph 5 is the mortgage, and it's not really in the record. Perhaps you could glean from the record that Anastad purchased the property back in 1997, but I don't think it's really all that relevant unless the court had to think
about it. I thought that was already in the record, that it was purchased previous and the mortgage occurred in 2008. I thought that was somewhere I read it. Maybe it was in the report, the recommendation to the district court.
Okay.
In any event, this doesn't matter, does it, to our analysis?
It shouldn't matter. That's right, Your Honor. The only reason I also mentioned it, I mentioned it in case there was any question from the court about what was happening at the time of the mortgage and the grant of that mortgage. And appellant doesn't make this argument, but had there been, for example, a notice of lis pendens filed at that time that culminated in the settlement agreement, that culminated in this agreement to terminate the easement rights, then the mortgagee would have been on notice that there was some outstanding right that it could potentially take a mortgage subject to. But that's not here. That didn't happen in this case, and that's the reason I point that out. I also want to point to the declaration of Declaration of Alejandro Lopez, index number 29, in case there's any questions from the court about the quitclaim deed that occurred after the litigation from Anastad against the mortgagee and the foreclosure. And in that declaration, Mr. Lopez, on behalf of U.S. Bank National Association, states that he's familiar with the quitclaim deed and that he didn't intend, and the Truman, the legal title holder did not intend any merger of title interest received in the Onistad quitclaim deed and the title interest that Truman obtained in the mortgage foreclosure. So when that quitclaim deed was issued, there was no intention, and appellant hasn't made this argument explicitly, but it sounds like their argument, one of their arguments is that quitclaim deed affected some sort of merger of title such that when the mortgagee settled that litigation with Onistad, that it took subject to the easement termination agreement, and that wasn't the case. The other point I'd like to make regarding the argument from appellant was that the agreement provided for a sale from Onistad to Mandel, the appellant, and it provided for a payment to Onistad of the $75,000. It didn't provide for any payment to the mortgagee, so there was no beneficial interest to the mortgagee in that agreement. And unless your honors have other questions, I think I'm willing to concede the rest of my time. Maybe if you don't mind, I'd just discuss briefly the burdens of proof. The respondent provided all the requirements needed to meet its burden of proof for summary judgment, and courts have said, especially the U.S. Supreme Court, and has said that if a party fails to carry its initial burden of production, then the other party does not have to produce any evidence or response, even if the latter party would have the ultimate burden of persuasion at trial. And in this case, a respondent met its burden of production. There obviously was no response, and the appellant didn't provide anything for the respondent to rebut, and therefore the court was correct in granting summary judgment. And then finally, the...
The district court didn't grant it just based on, didn't just say, well, you know what, there's no response, defendant wins. The district court provided an opinion. Does that get around, why doesn't that get around Thiel v. Stitch? Such that the issues were, the legal issues that were decided by the court can be resolved on appeal, even without argument by the appellant in the district court. That's the argument, and why doesn't that argument prevail so that we get to the merits?
I think the Thiel v. Stitch has two points, and one of the points I think is the one that Your Honor's made, and the other one is that when there's been no response, that the Court of Appeals need not consider the arguments that they didn't make below, that the appellant didn't make below. So I think the other part of Thiel v. Stitch is applies here, and the court doesn't need to consider the arguments that weren't raised below.
Now, was Thiel v. Stitch a summary judgment case?
I believe so, Your Honor, but I can't recall exactly.
The reason I'm asking is we have de novo review and summary judgment as opposed to some type of discretionary review of a discretionary decision.
On that point, I think the last thing that I wanted to mention was that the federal courts have an abandonment rule regarding affirmative defenses and other arguments that were raised in a pleading but were not raised in response to a motion. And this might be an opportunity for this court to adopt that rule. I didn't find any cases where this court had adopted that kind of rule, but the federal courts have said that where an appellant failed to respond to a motion, the defendant's or appellant's failure to respond to and assert its affirmative defenses is an abandonment of those defenses. And this principle applies equally to designating genuine issues of material fact and legal arguments. So I think the court could, if it needed to or wanted to, could adopt that rule here and determine that the appellant abandoned his arguments that were listed in the pleading. I don't have anything else, Your Honor. I'd ask the court to affirm.
All right. Doesn't appear there's any other questions, so thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes on rebuttal.
So the start with the importance of the quitclaim deed. We did not, in the written submissions, do not today argue a merger. This is meant to show what the quitclaim deed can be used in two ways. I think the first way to the first issue is that it is an example of the type of consent to or subordination to a prior interest, which would be an appurtenance, which it says in the quitclaim deeds, take together with appurtenances. Excuse me. The second way to use it is more germane to the issue of good faith, in that the previous property owner, Anastad, sold via quitclaim deed the property to respondent, and that should have triggered the easement termination agreement at that time. And similar to what...
Wait, isn't your cause of action then against Anastad and not the mortgagee?
I think there's certainly a argument to be made that there is a type of claim against Anastad. However, what I would point to again is Benson's versus Willer, where the mortgage holder would have taken the place of the landlord on a lease agreement. And there's no reason that this should be treated any different, where respondent could come in and take the place of Anastad.
Well, there's a slight difference. I mean, a lease agreement, I mean, those run with the land. I mean, you've got here an agreement that's on record, but the agreement itself is between your client and the owner of the other property, and doesn't on its face extend to any successive purchaser.
Well, and that's my understanding of the lease agreement in Willer, is it was an agreement between the property owner and someone else, and that it would have been, and actually was extinguished by a foreclosure action, because there was no implied or express consent for the mortgage holder to take it over. So that's the point I'm trying to make, is if the court had indicated that it could have gone the other way if the mortgage holder had taken some type of action to show consent, or made some type of agreement to show consent to take on the lease. The other thing I wanted to direct this court to is an unpublished decision in this court, Polzin v. Oust, and I'd cited that in my briefing, but that is an example of a case where there was an unopposed summary judgment motion where this court had heard several issues, and what the court made the distinction on there for what was preserved and what wasn't is where the court had erred as a matter of law. And here, that's what we're arguing, is that it completely misapplied Crablex, which would allow the mortgage holder to subordinate its interest in the mortgage to this lease agreement.
So, what about the abandonment argument that Respondent's Counsel raises? Because you have an affirmative defense, it's pled in the in there, and then nothing, the affirmative defense is not defended. So why couldn't we go down an abandonment road?
Well, I didn't find any case law in this court or in the state on that either. So it would be a first that I'm aware of where this court would rule that it was an abandonment.
Well, we may not call it an abandonment, but just the nature of an affirmative defense places the burden on the party asserting the defense to carry it forward. And as litigators, parties throw in the kitchen sink of affirmative defenses when they provide the pleadings. Even if, just sort of as a placeholder, just in case. And those are often left aside, like, oh, you know what, and never even mentioned again. And if that's the case, they're generally DOA. I mean, without necessarily calling it a doctrine of abandonment, they're effectively abandoned if they're left on the vine.
Right, and I respond to that in two ways. First is 508.25, which is the Torrens Act statute, says that it ingrains this idea of a good faith purchaser into the statute, right? So that is something that needs to be, I would say, needs to be established in the moving papers. But it's the other thing I would say about it is Mr. Steffes, who did appear at the hearing, one thing that he was allowed to say and the one thing that he did say is that the bank took on the foreclosure action with knowledge of this easement termination agreement. And knowledge of other people's interests cuts to the core of what a bad faith purchaser
well,
is.
Well, that may be so. I, just to differ a little bit with you, you suggested that we said the only thing he was allowed to say. He was allowed, the district court gave him full free rein and he said, I got nothing except for what you just mentioned. But in the analysis, what the recommendation indicated was that there's this assertion of good faith, but there's no argument as to what this means, and we don't know what it means. And so just asserting it that, well, there was a good faith purchaser or wasn't a good faith purchaser doesn't create an argument. It's not itself an argument. That's just a conclusory statement that I suppose then the court is supposed to go figure out what it means.
Well, one thing the court did on that as well is it did discuss within the context of bad faith purchaser, it did discuss what happened with the quit claim deed. And in its analysis, it sort of brushed off the quitclaim deed as this unrelated litigation, and which, of course, it wasn't. It's the same property that was transferred via quitclaim deed that was foreclosed upon. So with that, I will, I'm blinking red. I'm done.
You were the light.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for the help you provided today and in your briefs. And that is the end of our oral argument calendar for today. So we will be adjourned.
All rise.